Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, April 14th, 2022. I'm Maggie Lake, and here with me today is Jared Dillian, editor of the Daily Dirt Nap newsletter. Hi, Jared. How are you?
Hey, Maggie.
So what are you watching today? What's on your radar?
Well, I mean, everybody's watching what's going on Twitter, for sure.
Tweeting about Elon trying to buy Twitter. It's sort of a world in and of itself.
We can talk about, just about an hour before the Daily Briefing, I saw that the board of Twitter was thinking about adopting a poison pill.
Yeah.
And like poison pills are never a good idea, but they're particularly not a good idea after somebody has already put in a bid. They are going to get sued so hard. It's unbelievable. So.
Yeah. Do you think he's serious about that? Was my first thing. I was like, oh my gosh, Elon Musk wants to buy Twitter. I'm like, wait, does he really, or is he just screwing with them? Do you think he really wants to buy it?
No, I think he really does. I mean, part of it for the free speech reasons that he cited, but also, I mean, he's not doing this altruistically. Like, you know, Twitter, for all of its intellectual and cultural significance, just has a microscopic market cap. It's a snack. It always has been a snack for anybody that wanted to buy it. I mean, he can do it with his own personal wealth. It's just a fraction of what he has. So, you know, I think, you know, if he buys it at a $40 billion market cap, he could make multiples of that.
So you think so? Is it just because his mere presence, or, I mean, the guy's spread pretty thin. Obviously a genius, has success, you know, his ideas, for all his detractors, his ideas, not all of them, but, you know, he makes more progress than people want to give him credit for. I'm talking about on the idea basis, not always on the revenue basis, but you think he could make a go of it? I mean, what would be the difference of Elon being at the helm?
Well, I mean, I think Twitter would do more things to monetize its base. I mean, for example, one of the things that Elon was talking about in his tweets is, you know, having people pay for the Twitter Blue service at $3 a month and then giving them sort of a verified badge in return. And you would see, you know, hundreds of millions of people sign up for Twitter Blue in that case. I mean, there's a lot of ways to make revenue at Twitter, and Twitter is just been terrible at turning a profit. So.
Interesting. Do you think he'd actually devote some time there, or would he be able to attract the right people because he's Elon?
So I have a Coast Guard Academy classmate who actually was the head of security at SpaceX. So Elon wasn't his direct boss, but there was one person between them. So he was two places removed, and he worked there for 2 years. And he said he had to take like a year off afterwards. He was just like worn out. Like Elon just drives people really, really hard. Like it's, you know, the whole culture of Twitter will change. I mean, I firmly believe that could be an $80, $100, $120 billion company within a couple of years.
Wow. Do you have a position in Twitter, or did you put a position on as a basis of this?
No. And actually I don't recommend putting one on, because if the board succeeds in fighting him off, the stock price is going to go a lot lower, especially if they adopt the poison pill. So.
Yeah. Well, you think this would draw another buyer out, for poison pill aside, you know, I mean, it's always been talked about as an potential acquisition. You think somebody will, a billionaire battle, somebody else come out and say that they don't want Elon to get it, so they're going to make a bid for it, or a company?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. Yeah. And I think, you know, Jack is on the board. Actually, before I came on the air, I went to the Twitter website and I looked at the people on the board. Mm. And it's the board has, you know, there's you know, somebody from Salesforce, and there's a couple of VCs, and there's Jack and Parag, and somebody does public-private partnership stuff. Like it's a very cozy board. Let's put it that way. And I think they want to preserve the Twitter culture. I think they probably think incorrectly that Elon would ruin it. So yeah, they might be willing to accept another bid.
Interesting. Well, it's going to get interesting. And it's funny, the stock is down today. It had an initial pop, but it's down, I guess, on what do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, it's
are they betting that he's not going to succeed, or are they just betting it's going to be a mess, or, you know, what do you think that price action's about?
Probably that he's not going to succeed, that the board is going to fight him off. Yeah. Yeah. So
this is going to be a juicy one. That's going to keep us entertained for the next few weeks for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt Levine is going to have some more things to say about this.
And, you know, it's funny because Elon, you don't always see him, and he was out at that TED. I guess it was previously arranged, but he was at that TED conference today talking tons about it too, which was super interesting. So we'll see if we hear him being a lot more vocal.
Yeah.
Certainly tweeting about it for sure. While we were all entertained by that, the rest of the market, not so entertaining. We saw equities kind of back down again. They've just been chopping around this week. The NASDAQ giving back, I think, all of the gains that it had. The S&P 500 off 1%. VIX is up a bit. But, you know, it's interesting. We were so busy, and I was so busy with other things today. I almost missed that we got a pretty strong reading on U.S. consumers. University of Michigan reading for March came in strong. So you could say, okay, that's backward looking. But the future expectation component was strong too. That sort of surprised me given what's going on with inflation.
You know, not being somebody who like really digs into the data, I don't know if I'm supposed to be surprised or not surprised. You know, one of the things I hear from people, actually, every Thursday morning, I go on like the local radio show and I talk about markets and stuff. And the two radio hosts that I was on with, they said, well, we're in a recession. Like, we're definitely in a recession. I'm like, oh, actually, we're not in a recession. Like, it feels like a recession because inflation is so high and consumer confidence is so low because of inflation. But, you know, I mean, the labor market is super tight and inventories are low and the economy is running hot. Like, this is not a recession. Like, you will know when we're in a recession. So,
but it's interesting they felt that way.
Yeah, they do. And that's true of a lot of people. You know, John Malden, my boss at Malden Economics, you know, he's writing in Thoughts from the Frontline. He's saying we're already in recession, and I disagree with him, but I guess we are kind of on a forward basis.
That's why I was surprised to see the sentiment reading come in, or, you know, at least the future expectation. I mean, all these things probably lag even when you're talking about future expectations. Let's see what happens next month and put 3 months together for a trend or 4 months together. Because anybody who thought these prices were going down, maybe, you know, they figured, oh, it's temporary. But at some point, I would think that you're going to start to see that in spending behavior and in, you know, across the board for the economy.
The other thing that's happening is that rates are, you know, it's like Chinese water torture. Rates are just keep going higher and higher. You know, the tens are 283 today and bonds are over 290. Mortgage rates just went over 5. I think I saw a thing today on Twitter that said that mortgage rates went up 1.15% in a month, which is like the fastest ever.
Yeah.
So that's going to hit consumer confidence at some point. You know, I'm actually in the process of building a house. I haven't gotten a construction loan yet. This is happening at the worst possible time.
And you've got material costs going up and
yeah.
All around. You gotta increase that budget, I think, Jared, for that. Yeah. And this is the problem. People can't even get stuff done before they have to, you know, recalculate.
Yeah. Yeah. Rates going up is a big deal. I do think that at some point in the near future, next week or the week after, you're going to have an opportunity to buy bonds. I think the sell-off has been pretty extreme. I think we're going to get a pretty big bounce. And that's coming. That's definitely coming.
And are you talking 10-year? Where on the bond curve are you talking?
Oh, let's just say 10-year, you know, 10-year notes. Yeah. Yeah. You could retrace all the way back to like 230 or 240 and it doesn't really affect the uptrend in yields. So could be a pretty big move.
Wow. So, but is it a short-term one? Because you have the Fed continuing to say they're going to be as aggressive as they can. I mean, whatever language they can find, they're trying to telegraph that they're going to start reducing their balance sheet. You think, what's that bond move look like? Is it a short-term play and then resumes moving higher? Or?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, basically, this is a technical call. I mean, really, the trend is nearing exhaustion. You know, I mean, we're getting down to tag ends on higher yields, and I just think there's going to be a really big bounce. And I'm going to play it personally. You know, I'm definitely going to trade that. So.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Interesting. You know, a lot of people have been looking at the action in bonds and sort of saying, oh, they're telegraphing a recession coming. I know you just said we're not in one, but Weston Nakamura caught up with Joseph Wang, the Fed guy on Twitter. And Joseph brought up a sort of interesting, he's increasingly concerned about the fallout from these high prices. And he brought up a kind of interesting point as to why. Let's have a listen to that clip.
To your broader point, though, there's definitely going to be a recession. That's kind of baked in. And I think an easy way to think about this is, you know, what's an economy? An economy is what, if you want to have growth, right? How do you get more growth? You either have more inputs or you have more productivity, which is to say you have, let's say, you get more out of your inputs. Let's say you have a factory that produces cars. If you want to produce more cars, you can either add more inputs, let's say more labor, more materials, or you can have some kind of some kind of technological innovation that increases your productivity such that using your existing materials, you can produce more cars, right? That's how we get real growth. Now, what's happening in the world, though, is we're having the structural supply shock because of what's happening over in Russia and Ukraine. There's just less materials, just less stuff. There's less oil, there's less, you know, all sorts of raw commodities. So that reduces the inputs in the big economic machine. And if you have fewer inputs, you necessarily have fewer outputs. And when you have fewer outputs, that's basically less growth, which gets you potentially probably into a recession.
I just thought that was kind of an interesting way to look at it, you know, when we're looking at this inflation story, just that there's less stuff, right? That less material, less oil, less raw commodities, and that reduces the input going into the economic machine. I kind of like the idea of that. And I don't know, like, is that coming in your mind, Jared? You just don't think we're there yet? Or do you think we can skirt recession?
We're definitely going to have a recession. It's just a question of when. The curve inverted. You know, I think if the Fed hikes rates enough, and when I say enough, I would say that you'd have to get Fed funds up to about 4%. You know, one of the things I said at the macro experience is I think the yield curve can invert by a lot. I think we could have the most inverted yield curve than we've had in history, where you could have Fed funds at 4, tens at 2.75, something like that. You could have a massively inverted yield curve, which would be telegraphing a pretty big recession.
Yeah, well, if you think that, then you do think we're going to have a sharp downturn, right?
Yeah, I just think it's going to be a 2023 story. So
right, we're too early now.
You know, a lot of people have like sweaty palms about this. Like they really want a recession. And I'm like, it's just, you know, when the curve inverts, you have anywhere from 6 weeks to 18 months before you get a recession. And I think it's going to be closer to 18 months. So
that's, it buys us some time. Yeah. I think we both had the same impression when we were out in Del Mar at the Macro Experience Real Visions conference, that there was just a lot of, I don't know if we can call it doom, but it was heavy. There was a lot of worry in the room.
Macro doom.
it did feel, in fact, I don't know if you heard Julian and Raoul's conversation on Macro Insiders, but Julian started off by saying, I heard I scared the shit out of everyone. And we were like, yeah, sort of. But yeah, there is no shortage of stuff to worry about. So if you do think that maybe we've got this longer period, two questions. One of them, do you think that that gives officials, whether they be Fed officials or, you know, Treasury officials or, God forbid, politicians, a chance to adjust, make adjustments, right? If you're not doing things really rapidly and it takes a little longer to get into that recession, does that reduce the odds of a policy mistake? First question. What do you think about that?
No, I actually think it increases the odds of a policy mistake.
Oh, no. Yeah. Why?
Well, I mean, basically, the Fed always overcompensates in both directions. They cut rates too much. They hike rates too much. So if let's, I don't know what the exact number is, but let's just pretend equilibrium Fed funds is 3%. They're not going to stop at 3%. They're going to go to 4, 4.5, 5, whatever. So they're going to, because basically they're not going to get any signals that they should stop until after they've gone well beyond that. So,
yeah. I see your rationale there. They'll be thinking that they've got all this work to do. They're not going to be looking at maybe some of the earlier signals, which will be problematic. Okay, the next question is that's the case, taking into consideration both of those things, how do you play this as a trader? You just said there's a short-term play in bonds, but is there anything else you're looking at if people have the sort of timing of recession off?
I think there's not a lot to do in stocks here. You know, it's has been a pretty range-bound market, and I think it's going to continue to be range-bound. I have some long-term fundamental bets and some individual names, but, you know, I think the real play is in commodities. I mean, like, when we get recession, let's say next year, commodities are going to go down for sure, okay? But we have a very long runway until that happens. Let's just call it a year. You know, you're going to have another year where commodity prices are going to continue to rise. You know, a lot of people don't know this particular statistic, but December corn futures are up 21 days in a row. So, like, and this is not getting a lot of press.
No, we had a lot of conversations about food commodities when we were out in California. A lot of concern about that and them staying elevated for much longer.
Yeah, I mean, that's I mean, look, like, that's really where the opportunities are. You know, that's where the opportunities are. So
we have a great question from Mark on the RV site. How will Jared know bonds have turned besides price action?
I'm not going to wait for them to turn. If you wait for them to turn, it's going to be too late. And listen, what my style of trading is not recommended for most people. You know, most people say you shouldn't try to pick the top in yields in this case. You should wait until it turns, and then when it breaks, you should sell. I try to get pretty scientific about trying to find that point of exhaustion where I can actually, you know, get pretty close to the top. So
this is hilarious, and I guess perhaps you know this fan fave. This is a question on the RV site from Dirt Nap's favorite uranium a-hole. hey there. Does JD's, you know, I was going to ask a question when that came up. Does JD describe to the notion of impending food crisis, food riots?
That might happen for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, how you make money off of that, but that definitely could happen. I don't know if you know the story of the uranium a-holes, but
Fill us all in because we're okay, all laughing. But so, you bring us in on the joke, fellas.
So 4 or 5 days ago, I tweeted about uranium as a sector. And I said, look, like, I like uranium. Uranium is working. But I said, I don't think it continue to work in the future because, this is my quote, there are too many a-holes in the trade. And what I meant by that was this is a teeny tiny sector with $45 billion in market cap. There's uranium newsletters, uranium influencers, uranium Twitter. Like, there's this whole ecosystem of people, and they're as passionate about uranium as Bitcoin people were passionate about Bitcoin. You know, so it's one of those things, like, you tweet this and you think nobody reads it, and that ended up in the middle of uranium Twitter, and they've been making, like, memes about me and, like, they have this hashtag that says uranium assholes, and they're like, they're putting it in their names. Like, it's so, I don't have anything against the uranium guys at all. I'm just like, it's a cult, you know, like you get these trades that get to be a cult, and you don't usually end up making money in the cult. So.
Well, that is such an interesting observation, because I just came off an hour-long interview with Admir Adnani, who is the CEO of Uranium Energy Corp, talking all about uranium prices and the prospect for nuclear energy. So it is really, really fascinating to hear that perspective from you. So all the uranium a-holes out there, I'm sure you're going to want to watch that interview. And then let's circle back afterwards so we can talk about uranium. But you make up a really interesting point, Jared. So is it the same thing as saying it's a crowded trade for you, or it's departing from fundamentals? Like, do you look at the fundamentals around uranium if you see that? Like, how does that play out in your head? Because I think you talked about a cult around Bitcoin before as well. You could maybe say the same thing about Tesla.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I actually like the fundamentals. I think the fundamentals are pretty good. And yes, it's crowded. Like, there's just a lot of people in that trade. And just, you know, for full disclosure, I was long Cameco for a long period of time, and I did pretty well on it, and I sold it like a couple of months ago, you know? So I try to stay away from stuff that's a cult, GameStop, AMC, you know, it usually doesn't end well. And in the case of uranium, there's not a lot of liquidity.
Yeah.
So it could be a little unpleasant trying to get out.
That's a really good point. And I did not realize prior to sort of digging in and looking at this, that there, it does not sort of trade with bid ask traditionally the way other commodities do in the futures market. That's changing. There's a lot happening on price discovery, but it doesn't work like all other commodities. And this is the tricky thing about commodities, right? Like, they all have their different dynamics, which is why it's so valuable to talk to folks like you, and certainly some of the, you know, heavy duty commodity folks in our community, like Tony and Mish, and because these things are, they have their own unique characteristics. So you really kind of need to dig in and do your homework on that, is what I think I hear you saying. Sticking a little bit with commodity, Bob asking on the RV site, how do you feel about GDX?
Oh, I feel great about GDX. You know, the interesting thing is that you're starting to see a divergence between GLD and GDX, and I own both. GDX is actually outperforming GLD. You're seeing a lot of the big miners like Newmont. Newmont put in a 40-year new high, which is pretty astounding considering, you know, we're not back up to new highs in gold yet. So I've seen there's been a handful of gold mining CEOs that have bought their own stocks. Mm. So I think the thing with gold miners relative to uranium is that, you know, uranium is never going to get institutional sponsorship just simply because it's not big enough. You can't, if you're an allocator, you just, there's only so much capital you can allocate to uranium, but gold is huge and it's liquid. And when it starts popping up on the screen of some of these value managers, like, there's a lot of money that can come into that space. So.
Yeah. Great point. And that liquidity issue matters. We have, this is another one that there appears to be some inside knowledge here. Let me know. Ralph is asking from the RV site. Hi, Ralph. Would adding silver to the awesome portfolio help or hurt?
So within the awesome portfolio, you have a 20% allocation to gold, but it doesn't necessarily have to be gold. It can be any hard assets. It can be any commodities. It can be gold. It can be silver. It can also be Bitcoin, you know. You know, however you choose to slice and dice that 20% is up to you. The standard allocation is 20% to gold, just to keep it real simple. But yeah, I mean, if you had 18% gold and 2% silver, like, that would definitely work.
Mike is asking to bet on lower yields. This bond call piquing a lot of interest here. To bet on lower yields, would you go with TLT, EDV, calls on TLT a few months out? Question mark.
There's really a number of ways to do that. EDV. So EDV, for people who don't know, EDV is a 30-year zero coupon bond ETF. There's another one called ZROZ. There's less liquidity in the zero ETFs. You don't really need that kind of rocket fuel. I mean, if you buy TLT and get it right, it's going to be fine. One thing I have recommended in the past, a lot of people trade TBT, which is the double inverse TLT. It's negative two times short. So stay away from the leveraged ETFs. I wrote a piece about that for Bloomberg about 4 or 5 years ago. The leveraged ETFs will chew up your capital. So if you want leverage on TLT, then just buy in the money calls. That's the best way to do it.
You mentioned liquidity a couple of times. Is it important to think about staying in liquid instruments right now, given all of the sort of uncertainties, geopolitical risk out there, the fact that, you know, there's so much disagreement about where we're going? Is that something people should be? I imagine you always want to be in liquid instruments, but is it more important now?
I think it is, because, you know, the liquidity conditions that are present when you put a trade on may not be present when you take the trade off, right? Mm. So you always have to have a plan. You say, okay, well, you know, when I buy this stock, it's penny wide and 10,000 up. But then when I go to sell it, it's 50 cents wide and it's 100 up on the screen because there's some kind of panic going on. So you always have to have some kind of an exit strategy.
Yeah, good advice. I want to ask you, Jared, we talked with Weston yesterday. A lot of interesting things going on in Forex, big moves with the yen. Are you looking at that? And you know, how are you thinking about it?
So I'm looking at dollar yen, not really from a macro standpoint, but from a technical standpoint. It's breaking out or broken out, depending on who you ask, of this 30-year resistance level. And, you know, just as sort of a dumb technician, I'm like, well, you know, one thing I did, Stan Druckenmiller did not tell me this, but I heard this from somebody who talked to Stan Druckenmiller and told this story of he got into an elevator with Stan Druckenmiller. And this was back in 2012 when dollar yen was also ripping. And Stan turns to him and says, when the old timers know, when the yen trends, the yen trends. And it is trending right now, and it's probably going to continue to trend. So
love that. A little bit of history there.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Joe B is asking, what do you see as the nearest catalyst that might reverse strength in the U.S. dollar?
Is he short the dollar?
Joe, are you short the dollar?
I don't know. I mean, actually, you know what? You know what could happen? See, you know, I trade the charts, so a lot of times I don't have a catalyst or a story until the move happens, right? Yeah. So I'm seeing exhaustion in bonds. So my plan is to buy bonds. And if bonds go up, that might be accompanied by a decline in the dollar. But I have no idea what the catalyst is going to be. We'll know later what the catalyst is going to be. So yeah, could be something out of Ukraine, could be, who knows?
I mean, the problem right now is that, you know, these things could come from anywhere because there's so many moving parts of the markets. I mean, I know it sounds obvious to say that, but it is the truth right now. Especially when you see, Weston was really great at saying, when you see a big move like that in something that people are used to being very stable, then it throws models off, right? And that's where you can kind of get things kind of blowing up underneath the surface, and you don't really know when they're going to come to the surface, or come to light, rather. Related question from Edward. on the RV site. The dollar seems to be the only alternative for a global currency right now, but the U.S. has strongly incentivized the world to create an alternative. Could this play into the hyperinflation narrative?
I don't know if the two are related. I mean, we certainly have created incentives for a competitor to the dollar, but that is so slow moving. It's so slow moving. Like, you know, I've been hearing about the dollar as a reserve currency for like 10 years, and it's not, it's, you know, the probably the smartest thing I ever heard about that was somebody told me once that the dollar would no longer be the reserve currency if we lost an aircraft carrier, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. I don't think, but like I said, I don't think one has anything to do with the other. I don't think it necessarily has to do with hyperinflation, but we haven't talked about hyperinflation yet because, you know, one of my newsletters this week, I said, look, like, you know, back in 2010, 11, 12, 13, all anybody could talk about was hyperinflation because of the Fed was doing QE. We didn't get any inflation. Now we have 8.5% inflation and everybody's afraid to talk about hyperinflation, but we're already almost there. I mean, if you believe the shadow stats guy, John Williams, that inflation is actually 17 or 18%, and if you take the definition of hyperinflation at 20%, we are almost there. So I don't think, you know, we used to talk about these people like, you know, conspiracy theorists and stuff like that, talking about hyperinflation, but we actually have to start talking about these conversations because the psychology behind this is totally out of control.
Yeah. And that psychology, meaning that if people expect it to continue to go up, they're going to act accordingly, exactly. Right? Then you create a spike, which somebody, one of our guests rightly pointed out, you may not have that immediate knee jerk here just because it's been so long since we've seen that. But, you know, if you're in an emerging market, that this would be a different story. I mean, that is what kind of creates that cycle. And they know it well. Do we catch up with that psychology? I mean, I think that's really a really important question and point. What do you expect? We're in the middle of earnings, right? So do prices stay elevated? And are we going to see the separation of those who can pass on the prices? I mean, can anyone pass them on? Amazon's trying it. It's tacking a 5% search fuel surcharge, right, for third-party sellers. So we're starting to see it come out. Do you see a separation from those who have pricing power and those who don't? Or is everyone going to get slammed in the...
I mean, everybody kind of gets slammed. Retailers are in a particularly bad position. Some retailers worse than others. They're trying to pass along price increases as the best they can. But it's like everybody loses, you know?
Yeah, so. that's what it feels like. And, you know, they're coming from everywhere, right? So hard to pass it along if you just don't have it. And that's, I think, you know, circling back and ending on the vibe you picked up from the radio. That's why it's great talking to people locally, right? Not economists, but just people and getting their sense. And, you know, they feel it. They feel strained and it's hitting everyone, not just the lowest income barrier, but I think everyone.
They're pretty informed. You know, it's a conservative local show. You know, they're pretty thoughtful. And, the woman who, is the host, her name is Liz Calloway. She looked at me and she said, so basically these lockdowns in Shanghai are going to cause supply chain issues, which are going to cause inflation in the US. Right. And I'm like, actually, you totally nailed it. Like, you know, so, you know, even people who don't work in markets kind of intuitively understand the economics behind this stuff.
Yeah. You know? And they're bracing and they know it's going to be bad. Yeah. And they're feeling it already. So maybe we need to watch them as well as the inverted yield curve. Jared, yeah. So great to catch up with you again. And it was so fun to see you in person last week. We had such a blast. I hope we're able to do it again soon.
Yeah, it's too bad I was kind of sick. I'm like 90% better at this point.
But, oh, good. Well, you didn't know. We didn't realize it. You did well, considering. Yep. But thanks to all of you for watching as well, of course. Just a reminder, tomorrow U.S. markets are closed, as are some overseas as well, by the way, for Good Friday. So we will be back with you on Monday. So have a great weekend in the meantime.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.